Hi Medical Mums, and welcome to today's episode of Medical Mums Chat. This is Cheryl Chong, and today we have a very inspiring guest with us, Dr. Kim Liu. Kim is a GP from Sydney, a proud medical mum, and a tireless advocate for planet Earth. Kim has done a lot in regards to championing the government on all levels in regards to climate change, and is here to talk to us about how climate change is now affecting the health of our children, our unborn babies and our patients, and the things that we can do on both a local and federal level to help turn the tide of climate change in Australia. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and thank you for coming on the show, Dr. Kim.
Any medical illness is going to be impacted by the social determinants of health, where people are born, where they live, where they go to school, what work they do, how much they're supported. Itself has impacts on like the children because they have less ability to thermoregulate. The Lancet Countdown declared that it's climate change is the greatest threat to our health in the 21st century, and we had the Australian Medical Association declare it's a climate public health emergency in August 2019. And we've also had the colleges of emergency medicine, general practice, psychiatrists, physicians, rural and remote medicine declare that it's also a public health emergency.
Thanks for coming on the podcast. What we might get you to do firstly is introduce yourself to medical mums and maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do and the work that you do with the DEA, and then we'll talk a little bit about that as well.
So I'm Dr. Kim Liu. I'm a mother of two children. Now they're old children. My son Alex is 21 and my daughter Sydney is 16. I graduated from Sydney University a million years ago in 1989. And I am in primary care practice now for about 28 years.
And you're based in Sydney,
yeah? I'm based in Western Sydney, where I've kind of lived and worked for my entire life. And I'm currently the New South Wales Chair of Doctors for the Environment Australia, and I'm on the New South Wales Council of the Australian Medical Association. And I have my local doctors group, the Hills Doctors Association, and my local group is Hills for Climate Action, and I'm also in Australian Parents for Climate Action.
I've been following your journey through your activism for climate change and its impact on our health, and obviously looking at the long-term consequences of global warming, you know, and then things like that. What got you into this sort of eco-activism to start with?
So my background is that I grew up with Buddhist parents in a Buddhist household. So I was made aware of how important it is to value nature, the place we live, other animals and other people. And so it's sort of then it kind of, my mother's a social worker, so from the very beginning I was kind of really pretty much aware of the social determinants of health and during my training, so that any medical illness is going to be impacted by the social determinants of health, where people are born, where they live, where they go to school, what work they do, how much they're supported, And so over the years, I could see that I could see and smell the pollution. And because there's more cars on the road, I could feel the heat. It was getting hotter. When you work for 30 years in Western Sydney, you actually see the temperatures going up.
Because you guys have had a really horrible last few years in terms of peak temperatures, isn't it?
And so so 6 years ago, I realised that the environmental determinants of health were deepening social inequity and really impacting on social determinants of health. Mm. So, and it can make you feel powerless because you look around, it is getting hotter, but what can you do about it? It is getting more polluted, but what can you as a single person do about it?
Mm.
And so it's about, 5 to 6 years ago, I actually joined Citizens Climate Lobby first. It was a group of people who actually trained to actually see politicians about the impacts of climate change and a mechanism to actually help with the solution. Then I joined Doctors for the Environment after that, and sort of like I went head in first. So as soon as I saw there was something that was possible, and I mean, the possibility was actually, so my feeling of empowerment was seeing that other people cared about what I cared about.
Yeah.
And that if I don't actually do anything about it, like the people who are most vulnerable are going to have more precarious lives. And like climate change is actually making all our lives more precarious and uncertain. Mm-hmm. So part of, because it was actually depressing understanding what's happening. Once you read into the science and you see that, that the inaction and how there's so much inertia in our government in terms of going towards the solutions, and the solutions are here, and that it's possible for us to have a healthier future and a better future. You have to actually be part of the solution to be less depressed about it.
I mean, in terms of, you know, obviously you've seen the impacts global warming and climate change has had on health as a frontline primary healthcare worker over the last 30 years. How do you think, can you explain it to us, you know, what do you think in particular pollution and global warming has affected in terms of our health?
So if you look at heat to start off with, so heat is directly related to our level of emissions. And in Western Sydney, we had temperatures of 48.9. That was in Penrith during our black summer.
Oh my God.
And Western Sydney had 37 days over 35 degrees during that summer. And when you actually, heat in itself has impacts on like the children, because they have less ability to thermoregulate. And all our patients who have got chronic diseases otherwise, who are on drugs for their chronic congestive cardiac failure, their diabetes, their renal failure, their respiratory failure, all of these people are impacted by heat. Like, look, even if you look at kids who are on drugs for their ADHD, for their anxiety, for their depression, all of those drugs can also impair the ability to sweat. And to So if you look at, because pretty much all people theoretically could be impacted by heat. And because Western Sydney is hotter during heat waves by 6 to 10 degrees than the rest of Sydney, and this is because of the situation in Western Sydney, well away from the water, can be cooling, and with mountains on one side, and the way that Western Sydney is constructed so that there's more urban heat islands because houses are built close together and there's lots of black roofs, there's less vegetation. And so we have a really precarious population who are more likely to be impacted by heat. And so it's like when you have days, and we had the smoke during the bushfires, we had 80 days of smoke from the bushfires.
Yeah, I remember that. And that was terrible.
Yeah, so all those heat waves happened at the same time as the smoke. So we had particulate matter that was sort of 20 to 30 times the normal level during the hot days. And so people were really trapped in their houses because Australian houses aren't built to prevent smoke coming in. And then with a lot of my patients who are elderly or who are poorer, they don't have air conditioning at home. And once you have temperatures over 35 degrees, fans aren't just not as effective. And we know that, I mean, during the bushfires, you had 30 people, three people who died directly from the bushfires. We had 400 people who died from the subsequent smoke. And just with air pollution in itself, it's such a big topic because I actually go and teach medical students about air pollution. Most people just aren't aware that air pollution in Australia kills 3,000 people a year from us breathing in the usual ambient air pollution. So
it's a pretty frightening statistic. Certainly something that I didn't know.
Yeah, so
that's a lot of people, 3,000.
Yeah, so if you look at the mechanisms of air pollution is like a big soup of small particles. So they're sort of measured in 10 microns and 2.5 microns. And then the sort of the liquid air pollutants, which is nitrous dioxide, sulfur dioxide, and volatile organic compounds. And it sounds very very messy, but with the PM2.5, which is so small that we breathe it in and it goes into our bloodstream and every single organ, and it's a class size, not actually, it doesn't determine what the 2.5 microns is. But if it's from bushfires, it's from combusting fossil fuels, it's from those diesel car pollutants, then it is toxic. And we know from years of studies from even America in the 1970s when they had their Clean Air Act, they knew then that the toxicity of microparticulate matters. And we've got studies in, because we know that like even there've been studies done in Western Sydney and around the Hunter region, we know that increases the incidence of type 2 diabetes, lung and heart disease, and actually impacts on the size of babies during their growth, in mum. So, we know, and so there was, just with babies and growth, we know during the Beijing Olympics, when they closed off all industry, that's no cars within the city, no industries emitting pollution, that mothers in their third trimester had bigger babies. This is it's a very robust Chinese study.
And that's so interesting.
And in Australia, we have the air pollution and child health study, which looked at car pollution. In this case, they looked at nitrogen dioxide. And this was done in every city centre in Australia. So they had 7 to 11-year-olds within 2 kilometres of ambient air quality monitor. Like in New South Wales, we have 88 ambient air quality monitors, where it is an air quality monitor that measures the particulate matter and the liquid air pollutants, the aqueous air pollutants, and so that we know, we have a clearer idea of what the pollution is like in that area. And what they did with those kids was that they measured their peak flow and they also measured their expired nitrous dioxide, and they found that the level of nitrous dioxide is related to the child's asthma, level of risk of asthma. So we know that car pollution will actually impact on the lung function of children. And there are other studies around the world. There's a Barcelona study where they looked at 7 to 11-year-olds again and look at their cognitive function depending where their school is in relation to major highways. And they found that, because they actually did tests of working memory and found that car pollution also can have cognitive impairment.
Well, that's so scary. I mean, do you think it's gotten to a point where these sort of changes are still reversible?
Yeah, so they found that was reversible. There's still ongoing studies in Barcelona and it's reversible. If you have prolonged exposure, see this in Australia, we have the ambient air quality monitors, but we don't have the point of emission monitors, like next to a road or next to a highway, a point of emission. So there are a few coming in Sydney. So now if we look at reversibility, like with asthma with children, if they move to an area where there's no air pollution, then they can actually reverse that, because asthma in itself is a like it's that your airways are reversible. Mm-hmm. Medications, you can get better because it's not a permanent problem. It depends on where you are. But if you live next to a coal mine, you live next to a power station, if you live in Singleton where there's power stations around you and there's high pollution, the rates of asthma in those children, and they've been done by a couple of doctors where they did spirometries and peak flows in kids around Singleton, and found that the kids who live there have a high incidence of asthma. So, like, as doctors, we really don't think about air pollution. Like, each time we put petrol in the car and you smell the volatile organic compounds come out, each time you walk past a lawnmower and you smell the petrol from the lawnmower, like, and if you go and stand next to it behind a diesel bus, you smell the pollution from there. All those things are harming us.
So, I mean, that's the thing, right? It's so scary, a lot of these revelations, I suppose, because you're right. You know, you think about air pollution as places like China and India and a lot of Southeast Asia, but not something that's happening in your own backyard, isn't it?
And it's like, the air pollution is like worse in Western Sydney, because in a poorer area, they have older cars, older petrol cars. And so there's more pollution. And Australia, just in terms of air pollution, our road vehicles are a major emitter in major cities. So this delay of Australia transitioning to electric vehicles is appalling, because we could actually clean our air if we had vehicles that emit air pollution. The solutions start with what you can do personally. The most effective thing is to look at where your bank account and where your superannuation is. Are you funding fossil fuels from where you store your money? So that's in a really effective thing. There's a website called Market Forces that shows how much fossil fuel investment superannuations and banks have. Move your money, okay? Because if you move your money, that's a powerful thing an individual can do. The other thing is, eat less meat, because we know that, because it's not only burning fossil fuels, it's also that a lot of our deforestation is also driving the problem, and a lot of it is from clearing land for farming. There's Farmers for Climate Action, so I mean, there are we have ideas on how to improve the agriculture sector, but if people can have one meat-free day, that would actually help.
Because a lot of the world's agriculture is actually used for feed farming, isn't it?
So, yeah, so a lot of the soybean and I think most of the soybean grown is to feed cattle because of their high protein requirement. But there are ways to reduce the emissions from cattle and other sheep and the animals that actually emit methane, and there've been seaweed there's a seaweed that's been grown that shows that it actually reduces methane burped up by animal by 99%. So there are solutions for that, and there are solutions where farmers are actually changing the way they farm cattle so that it is more regenerative. But that is still, there's still a long way to go. But there's Farmers for Climate Action that is driving this change. And we're all working together. But it's also to make individuals feel less disempowered. And that's why there's even other simple things to do are to actually look at what you're buying in terms of your food so that you're using less plastic. Because plastics are also a fossil fuel.
Yeah.
They're made from fossil fuel. So that the choices that you make every day, if you can afford it, go to a bulk warehouse where you can take your own containers and buy the food and support organic farmers.
Yeah.
So your everyday choices are important too. And like, so active travel. So take a bus or a train instead of taking your car out. And if you can afford it, buy an electric car. Because they're coming down in price. Like, I've been driving my Leaf for 2 years now, and it's really fabulous. I mean,
wasn't there a law that was going to be passed recently, Kim, about the government putting a bigger tax on electric cars because they're not actually using any more fuel?
Oh, so this is Victoria. It's a very aggressive step. This is, but fortunately, New South Wales is not doing that. Because in order to foster any change in terms of societal change and behaviour, you need mechanisms to assist to start off with. And so if you look at the other countries that have, like Norway, who have actually got like more than 50% of their new cars bought, could be 75%, electric vehicles, they had systems so that electric vehicles didn't have the sales tax to start off with. They've removed the luxury tax from electric vehicles. There's no tax on electric vehicles like they're planning to do in Victoria. So, and to make it, like, even in the US, it's cheaper because it's a subsidy to buy electric vehicles. So manufacturers of electric vehicles don't even consider Australia a market because we don't have the sort of the framework to actually assist the transition of our transport. So the New South Wales government realises that we need to clean up our air and improve our public transport. So there are things happening, but it's sort of very, very slow.
How champion it to be faster, though?
Yeah.
You know, like, I know the federal government is very resistant to a change, and they're actually even pushing a fossil fuel-led recovery after COVID. How can we as individuals help with nudging that change over?
So I've been advocating in politics through my various groups for 5 years. And the clear message from politicians is that, oh, my electorate doesn't care about this, so I won't advocate for this. So in order to actually, one of the ways you actually have to make your politicians realise that you care about it is to write to them about the specific issues you care about and to go with your group to see them. But having said that, that needs to be done because the politicians know that the electorate is there and cares about this issue, but that's not the only thing you can do. If you join a group like Australian Parents for Climate Action, we also lobby for specific policies like lobbying government and getting them to agree for policies for solaring, for putting solar panels in the schools and to battery them up so that schools can become mini power stations. So sometimes you need specific mechanisms and you can, specific mechanisms that actually both parties will actually agree on because it just makes economic sense to solar the schools.
Yeah.
Because solar and wind is so cheap now. It just makes sense to actually do it. So
how do we go about joining these groups, like you were saying? Are they defined?
Oh, yeah. So Australian Parents for Climate Action, we've got 14,000 members now. And I think if every single medical mum joined Australian Parents for Climate Action, it's a huge cohesive group. And the bigger we are, the more powerful we are because it's a really inclusive group. And so anyone with a connection with a child they care about can join the group. And because with large numbers comes power. So if a politician sees that the bulk of the people within their electorate cares about this, then they're going to go out and talk about it. Look at Zali Segal. She got 59% of the primary vote in Warringah. So that's because more than 59% of her population of her electorate care about this, and she's such an amazing advocate for climate change. There's also Helen Haynes. There's all these sort of individuals who actually have their community at heart who are supported by the community. Most of us don't even know our politicians and where they stand regarding issues.
Yeah. I think it is you know, medical mums, I think it's a very niche group in that you know, we have the power, we have money to actually move. You know, where we have obviously invested in the health of our patients and in the health of our children. But I think it is so overwhelming when you talk to them, because I know a lot of people go, oh, I don't know where to start, or I don't know how to write a letter. I've written letters to different people, and it gets really depressing because no one ever writes back. You don't even get an acknowledgement email from, you know, your local member of parliament that they've even read the letter that you spent time on. And it's just so depressing.
So that's why it does take persistence, but also, like, it's really to join. It depends on how much you want to, because advocacy is at different levels. So, like, all the personal choices are important, but it's the political will at the federal level. So really to join your group, like, my really active group is Hills for Climate Action. So this is, I live in a really conservative electorate where the primary vote for my local member is close to 79%. So it's still actually just letting them know there's more people. Like, what I do is I let my local members know there's more people who care about this. And with my local group, we're also running for council. So our council is super conservative, but six of our members are running for council in my local group.
Right.
So it's really, local advocacy is really important. And how much time you can invest in doing all of this, because I think I do probably about 20 hours of voluntary work per week, is how, like, I feel I do all this work because I just see that this is the critical time in the next few years to give myself 100%, besides working to maintain a living so I can actually pay for everything, to actually be active. So it's maybe, I'm just wondering whether it'd be useful having like a webinar or Zoom to go through the nuts and bolts of doing things, because it's really
I think it would be great for, like, from a medical perspective, because I know that I myself, like, get anxiety just even thinking about, you know, the fact that we've now surpassed 1.5 degrees of global warming. There's no going back to that. And if we ever hit 4, half the population will starve to death. And sometimes I think about it and I get so paralyzed with anxiety, thinking, why aren't more people aware of this, and why aren't we doing more, and why is the government so focused?
It is disempowering, but the way I look at it, it's the way I live. I have almost a zero carbon footprint at home because I've got the panels and the battery, and my whole system runs from my house, and my retailer runs on renewable energy as well, and I've saved money at $210 per quarter for my power bill, and that makes that so I don't contribute to emissions from me. And I try to, like, my kids have been thrifting forever. So we go, like, one of the big fun things my daughter and I have been doing for years is just going to Salvos and Salvation Army and looking for our bargain. And my daughter wears my clothes and I've taught her to sew. And so these are things to do every day to see that you're actually not contributing to the problem. So sometimes the way you live actually helps your mental state as well. Starting with that and having your money in the right place and knowing your money's doing good and not funding fossil fuels actually helps your mental state. And these are things you can do. I mean, we've been eating vegetarian. My kids led the way because my son he's still in the Australian Youth Climate Coalition, and he led the way. He wanted to be vegan. So once one person wants to be vegan in a household, and this happened 3 years ago, we kind of all became vegan, except for the eggs from my chickens. And so I have a garden as well, so I know there's...
Yes, it's a very enviable garden.
And so I try to grow most of the stuff from my garden. So half the time we do, half our meal is, a quarter to half our meal is from the garden. And so then I try to not use too much plastic, although it's really hard because the system doesn't allow us to be low plastic. But I try to get my stuff organic. So you support those people who are driving the systems change, and that helps your mental state as well. So all these things, the way you live, but the onus is still not on us. It's on corporations and the government to make the move.
Right.
So starting with actually living in a way that you know is not contributing to the problem actually really does help your mental state.
I think it's so important to vote right as well, you
know. Oh, absolutely. But when you have no choice, okay, yeah. When you have no choice, when you're in a safe seat, like I'm in my state member also has like a 79% primary vote. So where we're starting is with the council.
Yeah.
If you can't, you have no one that you can vote for at the local level, you actually get someone in there that actually you want to vote for. That's why there's so many groups within Australia now who are looking. Have you heard of the Voices group? There are Voices of Indy, which...
No.
No, okay. So the Voices group was also what happened with Zali. So you had the community mobilising to actually see what the community wants and then finding a candidate to actually run.
Right.
And so Karen Phelps was also, because I helped work in Karen Phelps' campaign on the ground. So Karen, because at that time, there was no, people were really angry at what happened politically. And so Karen became successful at that time because her community cares about climate change. And then there's Voices of Indy, where we had Rebecca McGowan first. And Voices of Indy is in Victoria, the electorate. And now they have Helen Haynes, who works in public health, and she is an absolute champion for climate change. So there's Voices groups now for the Riverina, for North Sydney, for Wentworth, mm-hmm. For Hume.
Okay.
So these are community groups who engage with the community, see what the community care about, and look for ways to actually find someone they want to vote for.
That's actually not a bad idea. It's actually quite smart, I suppose, like infiltrate it from the inside.
Oh, so it's actually, yeah, so you get someone.
Mm.
And so it's really hard because if you see someone from the major parties, they're sort of tied to their policies, and both our two major parties are tied to sections of the fossil fuel industry. And so, I mean, we've got this $600 million gas project that in Curry Curry that they want to do, where it's going to employ 10 people in the future and only work for 2% of the time. It just doesn't make sense. All these fossil fuel projects that we don't need, because we know that within Australia we're capable of running fully on wind and sunshine, and the battery technology is gradually getting better, and we have enough
and
gas
cheaper.
In the system
yeah.
and cheaper, and we have enough gas in the system to firm the system already, and we don't need extra fossil fuels. I mean, Australia is the biggest exporter of gas and coal in the world. So we're exporting climate change to the rest of the world.
I know. It's
just embarrassing in other countries and devastating.
And I guess the other thing also is we don't even realize that it's not just about, you know, going green or whatever. Like you said earlier on, it has such a big impact on our health that we need to actually look at that from that perspective. You know, it's actually affecting our children, the way our babies grow, and you know, it's not just about money and
it's not about money.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, the Lancet Countdown declared that it's climate change is the greatest threat to our health in the 21st century, and we had the Australian Medical Association declare it's a climate public health emergency in August 2019, and we've also had the colleges of emergency medicine. General practice, psychiatrists, physicians, rural and remote medicine declare that it's also a public health emergency. Mm. So 80% of colleges have declared it a public health emergency already.
So that's a good start though, isn't it?
Yes. And so, like, it still hasn't shifted. I mean, we've been lobbying government for a while now in terms of the health. And the New South Wales government, we've also been lobbying for a sort of sustainability unit within the Department of Health that looks, because 7% of Australia's emissions is from the health sector.
Okay. Yeah, I've heard
something
like that before. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's actually still a significant amount. So our hospitals still run on fossil fuels for energy.
Well, because that's like a completely different conversation altogether, isn't it? Because I think it is, it'd be nice to have another podcast to talk about how to green health.
Yeah, you know, so, this is such a huge topic. And I think this is part of why I've got my finger in so many places, because I can see that there's a problem in so many areas. And it's really, as individuals who want to do something that really, because we're all time poor. Being mothers, we're all time poor. Mm. We want to do things that's within our capacity because we're all so busy, but that also is meaningful, you know, that it's a meaningful action.
Yeah.
So, I mean, different people will have a different capacity and to actually...
But everything counts, though, right?
Absolutely everything counts. That's why, like, just what you buy counts.
Mm.
So, like, everyone can contribute to the solution, but it's really getting to the point where you start doing it. And once you start doing it, it's kind of addictive. That's the other way to do it. You kind of like have this little competition with your friends in terms of, you know, how many trees you can plant in your garden. Okay, like,
yeah.
So, like, the other thing is, like, what helps me is my gardening. Every time I get a little bit angry or depressed, I go and buy another tree and stick it in my garden. So,
yeah, you can be living in the jungle soon.
So advocacy can also be fun because you get to meet other people who care about the same problem. Mm. And, like, the thing is that, you know, I don't feel the burdens just on me to do stuff because I've got such a massive group of people around me now.
Mm.
So that the solutions and advocating for the solutions are also sort of an empowering, fun thing to do. So that, because if you focus on the negative, and the thing is that if we focus on the negative and we're inactive, then basically the fossil fuel industry has won. If we're depressed and inactive, they've won. So if we engage in the solution, it helps us.
No, that's true. That's true. You're right. You know, like it's so easy to be paralyzed by anxiety surrounding these things. But I think you know, small things to start with, and then once you get the hang of it, you know, it's about joining advocacy groups and writing to your members of parliament and then voting right, moving your money, because that's a collective. We have a lot of money we can move, and I think that's quite important as well. We have a lot of power.
Yeah. So. That's right. And because we're doctors, like if we talk to our patients, even like simply eating having one meat-free meal per week and just walking, because it's healthy to walk instead of driving the car. So things that we talk to our patients about being healthier actually helps as well.
True.
So, and we know that eating less processed foods is healthier, and the more process intensive a food is, the further away it's made, the more the larger the carbon footprint. So we can actually influence our patients as well. So with my patients who can afford it, I say, well, go and do what I do, you know, like with the food. Or with my patients who have a low income, to say, look, plant a herb garden. If you've got a styrofoam box, you can start like a herb garden.
Yeah,
it doesn't cost much. But we can actually start people growing things, and growing things is creative.
Yeah.
So it helps you have a little bit more food security as well.
That's true.
So,
And you feel like you're doing something.
yeah, and like whoever has a garden, I encourage everyone to buy chickens. So a lot of my patients now have chickens
Yeah.
because it helps with sort of cycling food waste. Like we have no food waste at home because the chooks eat it all up. And
Yeah.
so then they lay eggs so that they're the best pets in the world because
Yeah.
they help the environment.
You've got me interested about chickens now. I'm going to go look it up.
it's sort of like as doctors, we can be powerful in terms of advocacy with educating our patients.
Great. All right, look, Kim, thank you very much for talking to us about it.
That concludes today's episode of Medical Mums Chat. Thank you so much for listening in, and we thank you very much to Dr. Kim for giving us her time. Dr. Kim has very kindly volunteered to run a solution-based webinar for those of us interested in solution-based problems in tackling climate change. And that would include helping us write letters to our members of parliament, as well as other discussions that and questions that you might have. For those of you who are interested, please drop me a line and we can get the webinar up and running. We hope you enjoyed listening to us today. If you have a story you want to tell, please get in touch. And in the meantime, please look after yourselves and each other.